Mrs. Hull was a delightful person to be around, but Frank was another specimen altogether. He was an entomologist of worldwide renown. His collection of flies was stupendous. He had collected from all over the world. In his latter years, he published through the Smithsonian Institution, and he collaborated regularly with the British Museum. He was, however, unpredictable, to put it mildly. Your dealings with him could be amusing or exasperating, depending on how close they were and whether they were of a professional or a personal nature. So when the word went out about this degree business, Frank went into the office and asked for a year's leave of absence. One calendar year, as I heard it. Purpose? To get a PhD degree. Where from? Harvard. Impossible. I'll be back in a year with the degree. And so, as I heard the story, he walked into Dr. Butts's office at the end of one calendar year. And when Dr. Butts looked up in his abrupt way and says, "Well," Frank spread out on his desk an authentic degree from the Harvard University. And that included time for a trip to Europe to investigate their collection and to do the actual writing of the thesis. Frank was more like a cricket than anything I know. When you thought you had him cornered and put your foot down, or your thumb down, he simply wasn't there. Being a member of the faculty now, and being admitted to the circle of friendship of my older professors, I began to pick up little interesting bits of university history. An item: the second president of the university, Augustus Baldwin Longstreet, had been a candidate for the position as first president. And he expressed the opinion that he would have been elected that first time if there hadn't been an infidel on the board. He himself was an ordained Methodist minister. There was a Catholic on the first board, and you can sort that little bit of business out to suit yourself. There was a professor of Latin in the early 1790s, apparently just preceding Bondurant. He lived in the old steward's house, which was the site of the present chemistry building. He was extremely unpopular with his students, and his name was Hogg. He got an act of the legislature passed, changing his name to Hogg, H-O-G-U-E. Whereupon the students painted a sign on the sidewalk in front of his house: "Hogg by name, Hogg by nature, Hogg by act of legislature." The old boardroom, which was a space where the present registrar's office is, the front offices of that complex being the chancellor's office, then the boardroom, and then a big room to the west. That old boardroom had in it a heavy oak conference table. I believe they call it fumed oak in those days. One end of it was heavily scarred with deep dents, and I had often wondered how it got that way. But I found out. It seems that some years previously, the faculty had been engaged in a heated controversy over some matter, and one irate member had emphasized his point of view by pounding those dents in the table with a Coca-Cola bottle, which he happened to be holding in his hand. Item: in the late 1920s, both Ford and Chevrolet came out with their first high-compression high-performance engines. Now, Bonda's driving habits had always been erratic. He was the soul of courtesy, and he would not think of addressing you without looking directly at you. If you were in the car with him, that meant you never could be sure where the car was going to go when he turned around to talk to you. This became a serious matter when he bought a new high-compression Chevrolet with a corresponding high acceleration. Students, I'm told, went to pains not to ride with him. And one day, he went completely off the road when going around the grove and ended up way in the middle of the grove. So Malcolm Guest went to Dr. Milden and said, "Now, Alf, you're Eric's best friend, and I think you ought to go to him and warn him to be more careful when he's in that car. He'll kill himself, first thing we know." In his most serious manner, Dr. Milden replied, "Oh, I don't think that's necessary, Malcolm. A guardian angel has been assigned to take care of Alec." "Well, what makes you think that?" queried Malcolm. "Why," replied Dr. Milden just as seriously, "it's a perfectly logical conclusion. If he hadn't had a guardian angel sitting at his elbow ever since he bought that new car, he would have been dead long ago." I heard a corresponding story about Mrs. Milden. She was equally erratic. And she reported to the book club one day about this taxi driver in town, the most courteous taxi driver you ever saw. "Why," she says, "as I was crossing the railroad bridge," at that time it was very, very narrow, "as I was crossing the railroad bridge, I saw him drive up and pull way off to one side and just wait until I got completely past the bridge and past him." When Mrs. Stone told that to her husband, Phil Stone, at dinner that night, Phil said, "I know exactly how the man felt. If I'm on the square and I see Mrs. Barnard coming around the square, I get behind one of those iron pillars and stand perfectly still and keep my eye on her until she is completely past." Item. Dr. Bishop once explained to me at a Scribblers meeting how it felt to be fired during the Bilbo shakeup. When Bilbo was packing the board in order to get a majority who would fire Dr. Hume, he apparently bargained with at least some of his appointees that if they would agree to oust Dr. Hume, they in turn might oust someone they disliked. Now there was a particular unsavory character. Let's call him Joe Doakes. He was a classmate of mine who had been flunked by Dr. Bishop. And for that reason, he found Dr. Bishop objectionable. And he agreed to get on the board and fire Dr. Hume if he was allowed to fire Dr. Bishop, as he did. Dr. Bishop explained his feelings to me that night by saying, "A.B., it was not simply a matter of being fired. It was the indignity of having to submit to being handled by such a fellow as Joe Doakes." Item. Bilbo brought in a vice chancellor, a Dr. Zeller, a medical doctor. Dr. Zeller had a very keen and inquisitive mind, and he was, I would say, slightly educated in physics, as most doctors are. So he called up Dr. Kennan one night, about 11 o'clock. Dr. Kennan was even then working on the mimeographed form of the textbook of astronomy that he later published, so he was working late. So Zeller called him up, and this kind of conversation went on. "Kennan, I understand that temperature is a measure of the average kinetic energy of a molecule." "That's right," And the kinetic energy of a molecule is measured by 1/2 the mass times the velocity squared. That's right. Now, at room temperature, the average velocity of a hydrogen molecule is about 1,000 meters per, about 300 meters per second, about 1,000 feet. Now, that's right. And the hydrogen molecule has a mass of about 10 to the minus 24th grams. That's a decimal point followed by 24 zeros and a, say, a 1. Now, that's right. Now then, they have just brought out a brand new 22 rifle that they call the Hornet. And it fires a bullet which weighs a few grams and which travels about 1,000 feet a second, about 300 meters. That's right. Well then, if the hydrogen molecule with a temperature about room temperature has a velocity of about 1,000 feet per second, and the 22 Hornet, which has a mass of some grams, which is to say 10 to the 24th, a few grams followed by 24 zeros and then a decimal point, travels with the same velocity, then its temperature ought to be some trillions of degrees centigrade. Is that right? Well, Dr. Kennan said, AB. You and I know that temperature has no meaning whatever when attached to a single molecule. You have temperature of a hydrogen gas if you have some 10 to the 24th molecules and they are traveling with a range of velocities from zero to very high velocities, but with an average of about 300 meters per second. And you and I know that. But how in the world are you going to explain such a subtle concept to Vice Chancellor Zeller at 11 o'clock at night? With a joint appointment in mathematics and physics, each department claimed half of my time. So mathematics gave me a 9-hour load, and the physics gave me a 9-hour load. And in addition, Dr. Kennan asked me to supervise the thesis of our graduate student, George Price Woods. It was a busy year, as you can well imagine. But I enjoyed it. I particularly enjoyed the close contact with a bright, eager, and appreciative student such as Wood was. This is a real compensation that a teacher gets. This sort of schedule continued until 1941 when I went over to physics and astronomy full time. And all this time, I was trying to carry on a small research project that I had brought down from Standards. I was a busy man. All this time, Dr. Kennan was busy trying to get a new building. The old observatory was redolent with atmosphere and tradition and almost hallowed by a world of pleasant memories, but it was hopelessly outmoded and outgrown as a teaching tool for physics. He first tried to go in with Dr. Morse, the geologist, to get a combined geology-physics building to be put on the site of Old Gordon Hall. That was a complete failure. On any given point, whether it was dealing with physics or with the legislature, Dr. Morse was always intransigent. This is why interdepartmental programs of any kind are so rarely successful. They look so attractive on the surface, and yet at least one member of any group will be so busy defending his own turf that fruitful cooperation is practically impossible. Giving up ideas of cooperation, then, Wild Bill went to work on his own. This first part of the story I got from him. Learning that the State Building Commission had an uncommitted residue of some several tens of thousands of dollars in its budget, for they had announced they were going to turn it back to the state, he got the elderly chairman of the Building Commission to come up for a visit. When he reached Oxford, Dr. Kennan plied him with a big noonday lunch and lots of good black coffee. Dr. Kennan always was an inveterate coffee drinker and cigar smoker. Dr. Kennan then took him on a leisurely tour of the building, which was then a regular rabbit warren because of the many additions, petitions, and so forth we had had to put in. In fact, Dr. Kennan used to say that to get from the sophomore laboratory storeroom to the front door, you had to go through the main lecture room twice. He took this old gentleman up to an obscure room in the western end of the building and then pulled out his watch and with feigned dismay exclaimed that a very important phone call he just had to make before 2 o'clock, and since we had no phone in the building, would he be excused while he ran over to the Lyceum? He would be right back. And with that, he left to light a cigar and stroll leisurely over to Lyceum and presently slowly make his way back. He returned to find his visitor sitting on the front steps and anxiously asking, "Kennan, where in the world are your restrooms? I couldn't find one. In fact, I could hardly find my way out to the front door." "Well," Dr. Kennan replied, "that's one of the inconveniences we've had to put up for more than 75 years. And then, after taking care of his visitor's immediate problem, he launched into his sales talk and ended up with a commitment for the remaining funds in the Building Commission's budget. He then made application to the Public Works Administration and enlisted the aid of Theodore G. Bilbo, who was then senator. Dr. Kennan had had much contact with Bilbo in administering the National Youth Administration funds on the campus. The NYA was much like our present work-study program, but much more loosely handled and subject to much more political pressure. However, it did help many a deserving student. Dr. Kennan once told me privately that he had never voted for the man, Bilbo, in his life, but that he could work with him when he had to. Well, the PWA was about to go out of existence, probably on January 1, 1938. At any rate, sometime in the last week of its existence, to hear Wild Bill tell about it, it was on the afternoon of the last day. He received a telegram from Bilbo's office saying, in effect, "I have just received notice from the PWA of the approval of your grant for your new physics building." Dr. Kennan carefully preserved that telegram so that later when people tried to schedule classes in our big lecture room, he could haul it out to show them that it was his building. This has always been a sore point with science departments. If you want to do a demonstration experiment, you have to have it all set up and adjusted before the class enters the room. You have just 50 minutes to do the experiment, explain it, and do whatever lecturing you want to do. Every minute counts. The result is that if you set the experiment up between 8 and 9 in the morning and some other department, say political science, occupies that room between 9 and 10, when you walk in at 10 o'clock to start your class, one of two things is sure to be true. Either the apparatus will be out of adjustment because somebody couldn't keep his hands off of it, or some essential piece of apparatus is missing. A small lens, a mirror, a caliper, or a pup from an air track. But to return to my story. A Jackson architect by the name of Neff was doing a good deal of work on our campus then. He was competent, prompt, and very easy to work with. He kept up with the building projects you hoped would materialize and dropped by from time to time to talk to you about them and to provide you, too, with pencil sketches so you could visualize what you hoped to get and what he thought he could provide you with the money you hoped to get. We got in touch with Neff immediately, and by the deadline, September 1, I believe it was, we had plans drawn and ready to go out for bids. Contracts were awarded and work actually started by the absolute deadline, which was January 1, 19. We did fudge a little bit on that deadline date. The former Dean of Engineering, Mr. Hargis, was then in charge of physical plant. So he surveyed and staked out the building himself and dug and poured by hand half a dozen, maybe, footings and sent the pictures to Washington as proof that the building was actually under construction. The building wasn't completed by February 1, 1939, but the contractor had been kind enough to follow our wishes as to the order in which the rooms were completed. And as we had been planning to move all summer, on September 1, we began to move in. We began meeting classes in the building with the opening of the fall semester about September 15. The final details were not finished until about January 1, 1940. But the 14 and a half months from the award of the grant to the meeting of classes and the 18 months to the actual completion of the building compares favorably with any other building project on the campus since then. We made some mistakes that leisurely planning might have avoided, but not many. The moving of the apparatus was a tedious job and involved an enormous amount of work, but it presented no essential problems. The moving of the telescope was another matter. In the first place, it was irreplaceable. If we damaged it, there was no way we could find money to replace it. We didn't even have money to employ professionals to move it. The brick pier on which the telescope stands goes down the subsoil and rises at least 4 or 5 feet above the level of the observing floor. On the pier is a cast-iron base for the telescope, a rhomboid in shape whose upper surface, running from south to north, is at an angle with respect to the base corresponding to the latitude of the observatory. The polar axis is bolted to that upper surface so that the polar axis, when accurately adjusted, points exactly to the north celestial pole. That places the north end of the polar axis about 8 or 9 feet above the floor level. We took the lens capsule off and dismounted the telescope tube with little trouble, but much trepidation. But there was obviously no way we could get the cast-iron base or the polar axis down the circular stairway leading to the ground floor. So we finally cut a hole about 5 or 6 feet square in the floor on the south edge of the pier so that we could lower these heavy pieces directly to the ground floor level. But even that was easier said than done. Those joists were 2x12 and solid, hard pine. I thought LD, our janitor, would never get them sawed through. We weren't sure what those heavy pieces weighed, and being amateurs, we weren't too sure that our tackle was strong enough to control that polar axis if it started sliding down toward that hole in the floor when it was unbolted. But I was young and full of beans then, and I volunteered to climb up on the base and do the unbolting. I worked my way gradually around the base from the high end to the low end, unscrewing bolts with an end wrench in my right hand while I steadied myself attached to an eye bolt in the dome shutter, and which I had wrapped around my left arm. We had no problems. When the polar axis was safely on the ground floor, someone yelled up and asked what I would have done if it had started sliding into me when that last bolt was loosened. Why, I said, I would have made like Tarzan and swung free on this rope and let her fall. And with that, fortunately holding on to the base with my right hand, I gave a mighty tug on that rope wrapped around my left arm as though I were going to swing on it, only to see the rotted end at the eye bolt break free and the whole rope fall 20 feet to the concrete floor below me. That was something. At the new observatory, we went through that whole procedure in reverse order. We had to pick up the pieces with an improvised derrick, swing them through the dome slot, and set them down exactly on the pier. Later in the year, Miss Hodge, one of our professors of physics, Dr. Hodge, she actually was taking Dr. Kenham to task for granting a student some sort of exception to one of our rules. "I don't know why you let Raglan get away with that," she said tartly to Dr. Kenham. He simply blew out a great cloud of cigar smoke and imperturbably replied, "Why, Mary Wilma, because he climbed up in the top of that dome and hung up there by his eyelashes while he bolted that polar axis in place for me. That's why." The next time you go by the observatory, look at that square which is inside of a square, which is inside of a circle, and is an ornamental part of the ironwork banisters to those steps. We copied that from an old Chinese woodcut, and it represents a very elegant proof of the Pythagorean theorem, which antedates Pythagoras, incidentally, by some hundreds of years. We thought it was a nice touch. By this time, war was in sight, and the Civil Aeronautics Board had established a civilian pilot training program on our campus. It provided the necessary ground school work and 30 hours of flight training in a Piper Cub to lead to a civilian pilot's license. Its obvious purpose was to supply a reservoir of men who knew at least that much about flying and from whom the obvious incompetence had been weeded out and on whom the Air Force could draw in case of need. By January 1942, the war was on us, and there was a general exodus from the campus of reserve officers on the faculty and of men from the student body. Our CPT coordinator was a reserve officer, and I was asked to take over. I was offered the magnificent stipend of $30 a month for the extra work. It was the biggest bargain the university ever got. But I had just built a house and could use any extra money, so I accepted. It was my first experience with any kind of administrative work. It turned out to be the most unpleasant experience I ever had. The language of the communication, the officialese, so to speak, was bad enough, but the instructions were revised at least once a week, and the volume of bureaucratic red tape was overwhelming. Worse yet, the word leaked out that CPT men were trained so that they might later be converted into glider pilots, and our recruiting dropped absolutely to zero. But at that moment, the Navy stepped in and took over our program, sending us classes of trainees. And believe me, the cure was worse than the illness.